everybody, and welcome to another edition of History After Hours. My name is Kevin Pumphrey, and with me, like normal, is Mr. Ron Franklin and Mr. Jeremy Nixon, three history teachers at Lakeside High School in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And we are recording this on January 12th, 2023, so Happy New Year. And we are recording this again at Collective Coffee. The students ask us a lot of questions, from dreams to music to history stuff. So they ask some interesting things. We hope you enjoy this podcast. Okay, we are back at Collective Coffee. Today is Thursday, January 12th, 2023. We will still say Happy New Year, everybody. And we have a room full of students staring at us, and they're going to ask us hopefully some great questions, and we're going to give them some mediocre to subpar answers, but we'll do our best. First question, state your name for the record, and what is your question?
I'm Ellie Uldrich. And my question is, what is the most prominent dream or nightmare that you remember?
That's an interesting question.
I've got it.
Prominent.
Okay, so I had this recurring dream when I was a kid for some reason. I have lucid dreams, which means I realize I'm in a dream because I'm a pretty light sleeper, and then I can control them or whatever. The trick, when I was a kid, if I admitted that it was a dream, everyone turned into werewolves, and it scared me to death. So I'm in the dream knowing it's a dream, and I remember saying, this doesn't matter, guys, it's a dream. And my grandmother, I'll never forget it. I was like 9. And so from that point on, when I have lucid dreams, I just keep it to myself. And it still happens. If I admit it's a dream, because my thing was, everybody in there realizes they're not real, and it makes them want to hurt me. Because they're just part of my subconscious. Now, that's weird, and I probably never told you that. Yeah, I think we have, I have lucid dreams, but okay. But that's my...
How old were you when you realized that you were like sort of in control, but not really?
I mean, I was 8 or 9 or 10 when I realized I had lucid dreams.
But yeah. Did you know that that's what it was called?
I didn't know. I figured everybody was like that. It wasn't until I was older that I realized some people don't remember their dreams. Some people can't control,
Do you dream in color?
I think so.
Here's where this stems. When I was growing up, I had this argument with my dad, and he was, for some reason, really adamant about this. He goes, you don't dream in color. You just remember it after the fact, and you think you do. I'm like, I know what I see. Because I remember, like, I've been able to wake up and go, God, those colors were vivid, and blue skies and green and really intensive, almost like neon-type colors in my dreams. Really intense. And he would be like, it's not true. You're just imagining it. It's all in your head. I'm like, it's all in my head. That's right, because I'm dreaming. I don't understand the argument. So I'm just curious. I'm like, I do dream in color. Do you?
I'm sure I do. Also, I'm like, I know I'm in bed, and I know which way I'm laying, and I know my wife's next to me. I know all that's happening while I'm dreaming, and I'll still be like, this is cool, though. I feel this against the wall, even though I know I'm laying like this, that I'm not moving at all. And that happens, I do it all the time. But, I'm a super light sleeper, so I'm always on the edge of awake and asleep.
Yeah.
Maybe even right now.
What's your nightmare, Nixon?
I usually don't remember my dreams, but I remember when I was a kid, I was probably 7 or 8, I had recurring dreams when it stormed, and it's so strange. It was the 80s. All we had was board games. It was like Clue, and someone kept dying in every dream. And it added on until I'm the last one, and then I'm like about to get murdered, I guess, and I wake up, and I never had it again. That was the reaction I was looking for.
That means you were the murderer.
I murdered myself.
That's it. I'm over.
That took a darker turn than I thought.
I'm over. Mine just has to do with like lots of fire. I don't know why. I'm not typically afraid of fire. I mean, I think fire's pretty. I like fire that's contained. You know what I mean? Things like forest fires and raging, like the infernos, for some reason, that's just really problematic for me in a dream state. Not often, but when I was a kid, more, I was like, wake up and just like cold sweat. I've been engulfed in flames, can't breathe. I don't know. It's been a while, but that's it. You, since you brought it up?
I had this nightmare one time where we were at our house, but it was like before it was finished because we bought our house unfinished, and so we finished it up. But so my dream took place then, and I remember there's this tornado coming to us, and I was like going out in the yard. I was like, "Grandma, we have to go," but then she's like, "No, just leave me." And then
oh wow!
But then we also we just left our pets and my baby sister in there, and then we set the house on fire.
I have a lot of tornado dreams too, and I think that means something. Like there's certain like you have like you fires usually your thing. Mine's tornadoes. I have if there's a natural disaster, this is when I'm dreaming and I can't control it. Although sometimes I can control a tornado. Anyhow, but it is interesting. You know, there's been studies done about it, but I don't know if it means anything. Maybe it means nothing.
I'm jealous that you all remember. I don't remember. You actually sleep, remember.
So that's good.
Well, yeah. I think it's more that I'm awake all night than when I do sleep. It's,
you know, they get all these psychologists and people who go, well, this is what your dream means, and here's what the symbol is, and this, and snakes, and blah, blah, blah. I just think that, think about this. You know, your brain is so concentrating on keeping you alive during the day. I got to remember to do this, and I got to remember to do this, and I got to watch out for traffic, and I got to do my schoolwork, and I'm busy, 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 and your brain has to juggle all that stuff. And at night, all it has to really do is keep your heart beating and your breath going, right? That's pretty much it. I mean, let's digest things. But it's really kind of a simplistic thing, and now I think it gets bored. I think your brain gets bored and shows yourself movies, right? Sometimes it's a horror movie, sometimes it's a action-adventure movie. I think that's what's going on. I don't think there's anything more than that. That's just my take on it.
A sleep expert said you have to dream, though, because if you don't, you will start dreaming during the day. You'll hallucinate.
Oh, wow.
Like, your subconscious is going to come out one way or another, either while you're asleep or while you're awake, because they've done, like, if they keep people awake for days on end, they'll start hallucinating, and basically it's like a dream.
All right, go.
My name is Joshua Weed. My question is, if you were to write a book, what would you write about and why?
Dreams.
Fiery dreams. A murder mystery where I did it, apparently.
I don't know. I mean, okay. Let's.
I'm not smart enough to write a real book. To write a book, to do a master's thesis, or to do a doctoral thesis is such an undertaking. So writing a book and doing the research. So the only thing I'm qualified to write a book about would be about me and my life story. So that's what my book would probably have to be about, unless I really wanted to do some work, which I don't.
I don't know what I would want to write about, and I'm kind of like Pumphrey. I don't know.
Would it be like would it biography, other people's biography?
My life is not that interesting.
I would do it about me or my family or where I lived, grew up. Like I would talk about that because
that might be interesting. Yeah.
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 I just don't know what else I would write.
I don't know. You've got this cool book about your family's history.
Yeah.
And so that might be kind of cool to research back and do the different avenues. And was there anybody spectacular that did something really weird or great? You know,
sold a horse to John Wilkes Booth. Yeah. That was my only splash in history.
See, I think we should go shorter. We should be really like keeping track of the crazy crap they do in writing screenplays for a sitcom.
You know, that is something that has crossed my mind. Some sort of book about... Not like, here's how you do education, because, I mean, we do the best we can. But, like, just the stories that students have come through with, and this kid did this, or this kid said that, you know, like, that would be...
Yeah, I have some stories.
That would be kind of, yeah. Not, we would change the names to protect the mostly innocent.
But not about education. Solution Tree has the market corner.
Yeah, they've got consultants for that, so, no.
Hi, I'm Lynn, and I want to know if you can answer this, but how will critical race theory affect what you teach? Like the ban on critical race theory.
It won't affect us at all.
Nothing at all what you teach?
No, because it's not in our curriculum. It's not in our state curriculum. It's not in the AP curriculum, and that's what we teach.
There's this interesting sort of push across the nation from people on the sort of the right side of everything, and they'll be like, we must ban this thing. And it's not really a thing. It's a conversation that some people are having around the country about the country's history and how it should be explored and how maybe we should interpret certain things. But it's not like critical race theory itself is a set curriculum with guidelines and books. And there's this onslaught of teachers who are just raging to go and do that and to tear down American history as it stands so far. But our history is continually under scrutiny from the people who are living it whenever that era happens to be, you know, whether it's the founding fathers trying to figure out how they're going to tell their narrative or the people who follow after that. And we, you know, when you get to the Federalist days and all that, or you get into Civil War or after that, early 1900s, like everybody's sort of approaching it a little differently from the moment in which they live. And so I think this is an element of that, but for some reason it's gotten a lot of people's attention, and I don't know if it's media driven or if it's politically, you know, motivated in some way to try to score points on in an election. I mean, maybe it's all of that. I don't know.
And also, critical race theory, you can ask 10 people what it means and they don't, everybody's got a different answer. Like, it depends on what the specific ban would be, because it would affect my class if they said, you can't teach about Black history. Okay, well, that's going to affect my class largely. So it really, what do they mean by critical race theory? I mean,
right.
It came from after the civil rights movement when things didn't, they expected a great change and they didn't see the change. So they're trying to figure out why. And is there a deeper issue that they did? And that's all it is. That's all it was. Now it has turned into a political tool that people use to try to pin you into a corner and tell you that we're going to have to completely redo stuff, and that's not really what it is.
I would suggest to you, and I don't know the percentages, but I would bet it would be pretty high, about most of the people who are complaining about critical race theory probably couldn't define it.
Right.
Yeah, and I was about to say something similar. And not only that, the original theory, the basis for it, stems out of law school curriculum that is not even really that widely taught in law schools. So this is ado about nothing.
It anchors in civil rights, I suppose?
Yes.
I've read 3 books on it, because, you know, I got to be prepared. It's about American history, and I want to know what I want to know. The top 3 best-selling books on critical race theory, trying to explain in modern books, not the old school 70s and 80s books. Yeah. And even they don't even know what it is. When they're talking, you know, they're all disagreeing on
what it is. The people who claim to be authorities don't know what it is either.
They disagree, too.
They disagree on what actually it is and the way forward. And
so it's not something that we're, I mean, ban it.
That's what
it doesn't, but
yeah,
it doesn't stop
it.
The conversation that we have, which is investigating the nuances of our society's development or the lack thereof, right? I mean, so we're always doing that.
We're going to, but I'll say this, and I think they agree. Nothing will affect our teaching. We're going to teach the best facts that we can. And if there's better facts, we'll teach those facts. And if it changes, we'll teach those. If they tell us we can't teach facts, that's when I'm out. If I can't teach what I think reality is, then I can't move forward with teaching. So as long as I can teach what I think is the best version of what actually happened in history, then I'm good.
Which also, by the way, follows the curriculum that the state has already set forward and the National Social Studies curriculum has set forward and AP and College Board have set forward. Like, we follow those guidelines. It's not just our opinion.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And I'm sure there are teachers around somewhere in the United States who are like, I have an agenda. We don't. And I can't think of anybody. We know a lot of people who work in this state, in this particular field. I don't know anybody that's actually going down that particular path going, we must indoctrinate children. I just don't know where that conversation comes from, actually. So to me, it just becomes political propaganda.
My name is Jacob Moss, and my question is, what is your favorite instrument except for guitar, and why?
Well, I hardly play guitar, so bass guitar. I spend 99% of my time playing bass. Now, if you mean that too, well, I grew up playing drums. So I spent the first 14 years of my life playing drums in bands and stuff. And if you are an aspiring musician, I would suggest you learn how to play the drums. Because I've been with band members who are great guitar players, but they had no rhythm. They didn't know where the one was. They didn't know where the downbeat was. I would rather have a mediocre guitar player that had rhythm and could feel the music and how it stops and starts than have somebody tearing it up, but is off time. Because nothing will get you ran out of a show like somebody that's just off time. It ruins everybody else. So if you, even no matter what instrument you play, I think learning to play the drums, especially the having your hands moving at different times and feeling the beat, I think that's invaluable for any instrument that you play.
Do you have a favorite drummer? Or do you have a favorite
drummer? Carter Beaufort. Carter Beaufort, Dave Matthews Band.
Oh, all right, excellent.
Or Travis Barker, Blink-182.
He's kind of, is that like jazz drumming? That's, is it
funk fusion and then pop punk, which jazz doesn't seem related, but they also cross over into everything else. So. Yeah. But I mean, I love all the Buddy Rich. I like all the historic drummers too. But Beaufort was the one that's like, oh, you can play open-handed? Oh, you can do, you know.
Yeah.
Favorite instrument?
I mean, I don't play, but I always have loved drums as well. I don't know. I just, that's something about that driving rhythm. And I'm a classic rock guy at heart because that's kind of the era in which I grew up. And so just a real 2-4 kind of beat, just drive that home. I love that. It gets inside my soul.
I don't really have a lot of just like favorite anything. I kind of, it's dependent upon mood. Like, if it's, I mean, I grew up playing the piano. I played trumpet in the band. I like hearing different sounds and different things at different times. So I couldn't just say, here's my favorite instrument. But I think everything sort of has a place, except for I'm not a big theremin fan. Like,
oh, yeah. Star Trek.
Star Trek.
I will say this, and this is because I'm old. If I'm driving down the road, she can attest, and there's real drums in the song, I perk up. I'm like, oh, wait, that's real drums. It's not a, just a, they didn't type it
the
in.
Machine,
the machine. Yeah, because 90% of songs you hear on the radio are samples. You know, they don't actually use, because drums are really hard to record. But when I hear real drums, I'm like, hey, that's a real drummer.
I think that's why I have, I like live music better than I like recorded music, because it just has that, again, it sort of gets, it's more real to me, you know, and maybe that's part of it. I never really thought about that, but the syncopated machine drum doesn't have the same kind of, it's not gutsy, you know what I mean? It's just kind of there, but live, like somebody just hammering that, man.
Yeah.
It's just part of what I love.
I'm Emily Williams. And I would like to know your opinion on the effects of, like, forced religion on children as they get older.
Okay, so this is a huge question that we could talk forever about. But, you know, we don't have forced religion in America. We separation of church and state. But maybe you mean, are you talking about countries where they have state religions, or are you talking about parents indoctrinating their kids with their religion? I mean, because those are,
I'm
parents
talking about,
can,
like, parents.
Well, you know, parents screw up their children in their own specific way, and religion is a part of that. Their belief system, they're going to want their kids to believe the same thing. And I think no matter what, every child at some age has to deal with that. They have to deal with what do they believe rather than what their parents told them. So if you haven't crossed that road yet, you will, and you'll have to figure out what you believe. Now, a bigger question is, how does religion, large group of people believing the exact same thing, how does that affect society? And that's, you know, that's a huge question.
I say that in class all the time. It's a personal thing. And I think Pumphrey's right. At some point you have to make the decision for yourself, whether that occurs in like late childhood, early adulthood, or later in life. At one point or another, you're going to decide, well, these are my thoughts and here's why I think it. And maybe that's the exact same thing that you've been raised on. Maybe that's the exact same thing your parents think, and maybe it's not. I kind of reject the premise of the question forced, because we all have some semblance of free will to reject even the things that we are being told by authority figures. And I know that you all know that as well.
At what age did that happen for you? Because I was in preschool. I'm kidding. I wasn't really preschool. I was pretty young, though.
Like specifically religion wise?
Well, no, like, just like when you were like, I don't have to believe what you say, like that kind of thing.
Oh, well, that happened pretty early.
12, 17, 22, 38. I think about right now, too.
I was one of those that questioned things very early and quickly. I mean, there, I was.
Did you have folks
kid.
Who would allow you to have that sort of freedom of questioning? Because I did too, yeah.
That's kind of where it's different. It depends on your socialization, how you've grown up, who you're around. And I had parents that let me challenge them. I had teachers that let me challenge them. I had
respectfully.
Peers that let, yes.
Let's be clear about that.
Yes. Oh God, if I had been disrespectful to anyone, my mother would have beaten me. She was a school teacher, so she would have found out about it before I even got home.
I'm 53. My mother's 80. She'd still slap me if I was rude to
her. Oh yeah,
to,
if I yeah, my mom presence, would yeah. too if I were rude
By
to her.
By the way, we just had this conversation in class. If you took away religion, and this is what academic philosophers are kind of debating right now, because we are moving to, the world in general is moving more in a secular direction. And so the worry is, if you have millions and millions and millions of people who have no religion, is there anything to base morals in? And there's, you know, can you base them in science?
TikTok.
Or can, I mean, maybe. So that's an interesting question, because most of our morals are shaped around a religious belief system. It's a deep question, and they're arguing about this in academic circles.
I said TikTok to be funny, but if you think about it, if religion is your shared cultural experience, and that has been removed because people just abandoned it or whatever, they've gone off and tried to figure out what other things might merge together to create the thing that they want to do. But if social media is a shared cultural experience for millions of people, and that could replace to a certain extent the morals that may have been set by somebody else.
I don't want to live in a TikTok morality world.
Well, that's not what
but,
I'm saying.
I mean, but if it does replace it to the point where whatever is acceptable, watchable, okay to take in via TikTok or social media, if that's the standard, like okay, I'm
well, but did you see the email that I sent everybody about the stuff in Britain where they're trying to figure out how to deal with the Andrew Tate effect?
Yeah.
I know who the guy is, and a lot of you do too, apparently, from the look on your face. There's this active movement in Britain from teachers and from parents and from politicians to try to figure out how to counteract the negative impact that that particular guy and the millions of followers that watch him, like, seemingly daily. Of course, now he's in prison or awaiting trial or whatever he is doing. But the way that he talks and the way that he presents himself apparently is really, really appealing to prepubescent boys. Yep. And he's become, in a weird way, almost like a guru, and that they model themselves after him, and they want to idolize him, and they want to be like him, and they're trying to figure out how to like counterbalance that with like, look, saturation in media and social, right? It's like he shouldn't be your hero nor your savior, but social media makes him who he is. You see what I'm saying? And so is that the thing that replaces, if you don't have guidance at home and you don't have some sort of path that you've figured out how to follow, maybe you're susceptible to people.
Remember the Charles, you all remember this, the Charles Barkley, I am not a role model, because people were trying to follow Jordan and they were look at idols, you know, I mean, there's been that, but now with social media, you're right, it can go pretty dark pretty quick, trolls and instigators. So we don't really know the full effect. That would be more of a psychology question, but in, you know, you guys grew up in a very religious nation. The United States is very religious. And if you live in the South and you're born here, you've grown up in a very religious area. So, but there's places in the world that don't have this kind of religious fervor. So that's a very different place to grow up.
And we know, too, that not everybody can have open conversations with their folks, too. If you are exploring some ideas on your own, like, it might not be okay for you to try to express things to your people because they might not react very well to that. I mean, that's a reality, too. I grew up in a household where they welcomed challenges, they welcomed ideas, and because they felt that if those ideas couldn't be challenged, they weren't really strong to begin with. But that's the place I grew up in. That doesn't mean that everybody has that same availability of questioning, and which may keep them from exploring different ideas too for quite a while. Like I said, I did that fairly early, but some people, it may be later in life when they do that. Yeah. And then actually it might become a crisis for them because they don't know what to do next.
Yes, I can, yes.
All right, go ahead, sir.
I'm Liam Jeffers. Also, I don't know if you got an answer, but the QR in QR code stands for quick response.
Ah,
gotcha.
Or, you know.
All right.
Hypothetical. Imagine it's the middle of the night, and you walk into your kitchen because you're really hungry. You see that your fridge door is open, and you see this little man, and you find out that it is a little clone copy of famous historical person Adolf Hitler. Now, this is a twofer. This is sort of two parts. The first part is, what would you do? And the second part is, do you think it would be moral if you, like, I hate to use this harsh wordage, but tortured or killed him because he's a little man and he can't fight back? Thank you.
I'm really, really curious about the development of that question. What should I ask?
Imagine a world. So,
I don't dream, but I sleep, eat, and walk, and shop, if you've heard my stories. I would probably knock him out of the way of the refrigerator because I'm hungry, and then deal with the consequences later.
Is it just him, or does he have a little tiny Nazi army with him?
It is just him. Okay. He is alone and hungry.
Okay. Makes it a little easier then. He's just hungry. He's broken into my house.
Yes, he's just very tiny and hungry.
I think you've got two options. Like, I think you can slam the door on his little head, or pick his tiny little ass up and take him to the garbage disposal.
Why did I start picturing Voldemort after he died when you said that? Like that little clump.
Yeah.
I don't even know where.
I mean, I think you have to stop him before he gets to the children, man. Right?
But he's so little. He's literally so we're not talking about normal.
Just
because
he's
little.
Cute doesn't mean he's not dangerous. Like he, right?
Yeah. Haven't you seen Gremlins?
Okay. Well,
he's got his ear pods in. And he's listening to Andrew Tate. He's probably not.
I don't know. I say hamster cage with the wheel. Just
put him on display, torture? Make some money.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
I was too quick to react. Too quick with the garbage disposal grinding scenario. Flea? Wash him down the drain.
Flea circus.
I don't, Nixon?
I don't know what you do with that. I still just want the food.
Wasn't there a show called Little Hitler? Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little false memory. Snippet. Yeah.
No, I have it on my computer at school. Yeah. I can prove it.
It's not a show. It's just a little
L.I.L. Hitler. It's an adult. And it's an animated thing. I think it's part of
it's an Adult Swim thing.
Adult Swim thing. Yeah.
There's a song.
Little Hitler.
I mean, I feel like you got.
Okay,
kill
I wouldn't
him.
Make it up.
Right. No, it's real. Yeah.
I feel like you gotta kill him. I think history will judge you for not killing him.
But would you at least like ask him questions?
Nope. Or right to the garbage disposal.
I'm really not curious.
My German is rusty, and yeah. That's up there with the weirdest questions.
That is one of the, top.
I can say goodbye in German.
Top tier, yeah.
All
right, go ahead, sir.
I'm Grady Yeoman, and do you think everything happens for a reason, or is it just by chance?
This is another philosophical question, so.
That,
is the universe deterministic or random?
I don't know how there could be a right or wrong answer to that. I mean, I don't know if we could pin it down truly, because on one hand, do you go, if it's random and that seems sort of fatalistic and, nothing matters if it's all random, right? Why are we here? That sort of speculation, On the other hand, if it is determined and preset, then would we ever have the ability to know why certain things take place? And maybe that's just beyond our comprehension, even if it is one way or the other. That's one of the, I think, to study history as much as we have, and especially ancient history as much as I have, that's one of the greatest questions from the beginning of civilization, and maybe even before. People are like, what is this? Can we predict? Can we know? In the times even before organized religions, they were just like, think about the weirdness of, I'm here with my friend, and we've known each other for a long time since we could remember anything, and then suddenly, he was here 1 minute, now he's not. He is, but he's not. How do you even get your head wrapped around if that's for a reason or not, maybe it's just, if you could take it back and look at it from afar and then see it all kind of working together as a mechanism, then maybe you could say it's, yes, predictable and organized, but I don't know how you would really, truly, I mean, I'm not that smart,
Yeah,
the greatest philosophers of all time couldn't figure that out, and they did grapple with that, so I don't know. I mean, personally, maybe it's a weird combination of the two, I mean, again, I can't prove it one way or the other, so.
Yeah, I think, once again, this is a debate that goes on in the neuroscience community, whether we have free will or not. We feel like we do.
Yeah, go down that path, because you said this to me before. Like, do that real quick. Sum it up.
It's a huge conversation, but apparently, the best way I can describe it is if you just closed your eyes and I said, just think about your breath, okay? And you were breathing, evidently within 3 seconds to a minute, a thought will pop into your head. Now, did you control that thought? What forced that up? Well, it was it's everything that's led to that moment. You had no real control over that thought. So just expand that with everything.
Can you control how you react to that thought?
No, because you would have reacted that way every time in that situation with your biochemical, the way you were. You never have the control because it's hard to explain, but...
obviously.
Yeah, it's the conversation you have with yourself. Who are you talking to? That person that controls... And we don't... Now, look, I'm not saying this is true. It's split 50-50 on whether free will or
it's
not.
It's an argument.
But here's what I will say about whether things happen for a reason or not. To survive as a human species, I think pragmatically we have to live like things happen for a reason. We have free will. We teach our kids that... our choices have consequences. And so, whether it's true or not, whether it's reality or not, we have to live and have a mindset that it matters, because the other way could be a dark way to go.
Yeah, pretty bleak.
I'm just not.
Well, here's a small example. We all know that we're going to die someday, except you.
Except me.
But it's pretty much, it's the death rate's 100% at this point. That should be on our mind. We shouldn't even go to work. We should live every moment because we know it's coming to an end. But because we can't survive that way, you can't live your life that way, we just have to push that. Oh, well, that's later. That's later. And that's how you get through the day. And you have to go to work and you have to make money. But if you really nailed down, if you knew, like, for instance, if you knew the exact date it was going to happen, I bet it would change. I bet you might not even go to work. You might not go to school tomorrow. You know, if you knew the date, even if it was 40, 50 years from now, if you knew exactly for sure that it was coming, it probably would change the way you did everything in your life. But we don't know. And that's part of it, is that we push it off like it's not going to ever happen. And even talk to like 80-year-old people, they think, oh, that's how you survive, though. We have to push it off. So there's certain ways we have to live. Things matter. Choices matter. Things happen for a reason, and I'll never die.
Don't you think that there's some extra comfort for people, though, in that idea that even if I don't understand why, but there is a reason somewhere, exactly. Somebody knows there's something in control, and that makes me feel better. It's almost like a self-soothing sort of thing. Well, there's a plan.
This is one of the reasons religion is so powerful.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
When, you know, if your child unfortunately dies, you can think, well, one day we'll be together again, you know, or whatever your religious beliefs, reincarnation, whatever it is. It gives you a lot to live for. So
there's a path, there's a rhyme, there's a reason.
Right. So these are big, deep questions. Come on, guys. Let's talk about something.
It's crazy. A new year. Deep thoughts, yeah.
I can't think anymore.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Alyssa Nugent, and I have a question. Would you rather go back in the past, or would you rather go into the future, like to a certain event or something, and why?
That's a good question. Because of what I've been reading, I don't know how far I wouldn't go far in the future.
Yeah, I would not go far in the future.
And I definitely wouldn't go far in the past. So yeah. I think I would like to go 10 years into
2015.
The future.
2015.
I was there. I know what happened.
I know what happened.
If I went into the future 10 years, let's just see kind of how some of this stuff that's going on plays out. And that's good for me.
I think I'd go forward. I don't know how far, because you wake up and everything's on fire, because you know how I feel about fire. So, I don't think I would like to go backwards, at least not very far at all. Maybe, here's what I would like. I would like to be like a hologram dude who goes and visits ancient things. Like, that would be kind of cool. I don't really want to be there. I just want to go see it as it was when it was happening, That would be kind of cool. If you believe in a heaven scenario, then maybe heaven has like a videotape room where you can go, I want to see the ancient Egyptians. I'll plug that in and turn that on and watch that video, or something like you could sort of descend down into it, maybe in a 3D hologram, sort of like a virtual reality, that kind of thing. But I don't think I'd want to go back, because I don't want to be, listen, I like modern conveniences, and I like entertainment, I like indoor plumbing, I like sanitation, I like medicine, I don't think I would go back too far, because they don't really have a whole lot of that. Once you back up just a little bit, it's not really that great.
If I'm going back, I'm going with full body armor, drones, machine. I'm going to be strapped.
Oh, you're taking modern stuff back over. With you? There you go.
Yeah, and I'm going to have people work for me.
We're also assuming you can come back, right? We can come back from wherever we're going.
Yeah, what if you're stuck? Yeah.
Yeah, that's... I'm with you. If I would go to the future, but very close by.
Yeah, you don't want to go to apocalypse and get radioactive. You just decay. You come back, you're sick.
Yeah. So.
Okay. All right, what's your question, my man?
Okay, so would you rather live in a country where there's democracy, or would you rather live in a country where there's no democracy?
Live in a country with democracy, or live in a country without democracy?
I'm choosing democracy, I think, unless I'm kind of just me and my family, and then it wouldn't matter as much.
I gotta know what kind of democracy.
Yeah, there's different kinds.
Yeah, if it's complete majority rule.
Yeah, that goes sideways.
That goes sideways fast.
It's honestly, I like to have some choices in that story, I'm not comfortable with the idea of one sort of overlording presence going, you will.
Unless I am that overlord presence.
Unless you go back with your drones and your armor and you become that guy. That's different, I suppose. I like to have some choices there, I like to think I matter on some level.
Yeah, generally my answer will be democracy, but with some caveats.
Limited democracy.
Yeah.
Okay. Limited.
Next question.
Okay, yep.
My name is Lexi Hammonds, and what is your favorite part of world history you like to teach and why?
You first. Well, yeah.
I'm Renaissance and all that stuff, just because I've been to those places. I love Italy. I love looking at the art. And so I think the Renaissance time period is cool for me, world history-wise.
I'm just a big fan of, shifting moments. Like you have this, you have like this before and after thing, you know, here's this person or here's this event. And there was some sort of way of life before that. And then afterwards, everybody has to sort of reexamine who they are. You know, maybe it's the Mongol story. We just got through doing Napoleon and the French Revolution stuff. I dig the 1800s sort of globally because there's so much dynamics going on. At that point in history, you've got so many people who are now no longer isolated in their areas around the world. There's a connectivity. There's a lot of positivity, but there's also a lot of negativity. We're trying to filter out how that all is supposed to balance. We're not quite to the world wars yet. You know, that becomes a whole different set of circumstances, obviously. So I guess if I had to kind of pick, that's kind of the moment, that era, the entirety of the 1800s. There's just so many cool things to dig into.
I'm just before. I'm Enlightenment. I mean, and mainly because, you know, when I pick up in AP US Gov or AP Comparative, after I've been teaching them, then I'm with 200 years of hindsight trashing them.
Right.
And that's just a fun pastime of mine, especially when we get to the founding fathers in America.
That's a very Gov kind of answer.
It is, yeah, a very Gov kind of answer.
Did you have a follow up? Did you have something else to add there? Okay, just making sure. All
right. Hi, my name is Brennan Wilkins. Do you think that teacher consultant services are like very helpful?
Are you a plant? Are you a mold?
I think it really varies. Would y'all like to start?
Yes. No. Yeah, I'm more than happy to answer that. They have been helpful in this way. They convinced our administration that we needed shared time as a department so that we could collaborate and that we could focus on our curriculum and how this class, you know, there's several of us teaching one class or the other, but there's several of us that are also teaching the same class across the board. And in the past, what's happened is that, and I've had students say this to me, as a matter of fact, I got this teacher and I got that teacher and so-and-so got this teacher and that teacher, and I feel like I won the scheduling lottery. It was random. Because the teachers weren't teaching the same class really the same way at all. It was just whatever they chose. And yeah, we have a set curriculum, but they were really kind of approaching it. I want to focus on this story. I want to focus on this avenue. I want to really spend a lot of time on this. So what this has done then has gotten us together every week and a lot during the summer. And we've really been able to hammer out, let's all do this a really nice, strong way so that no matter who gets what class, they get the same experience as best they can. Obviously, we're different people. And we teach in different ways. We have different personalities and different strengths and weaknesses. But generally speaking, we're much more on the same page than we ever were. And I really like that. And I think that's made the entire department stronger because we've had that collaboration time. Now, as far as like what they've brought to us and some of the forms and some of the things they suggested that we do and how we grade, no, that's like but I will say this too. They haven't shoved it down our throats. Like the consultants were like, here's a whole bunch of stuff that you can think about, and then you kind of take it and make it your own way. And so we rejected what we needed to reject. But again, that came from a conversation that we all had together, and we decided that it was going to be the best interest of our students to do it this way or that way. So like I said, in a weird way, yeah, but there was a lot of stuff we had to sort of filter out and go, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. So
great answer.
Part of what bothers me, though, is that we've spent so much money as a state, not just as a school, but as a state, one consulting firm as opposed to some other things that might have been out there to help us. We weren't given a choice in that. And matter of fact, there wasn't a bid from multiple companies to get that done. Select people from inside our state decided that this was the company and that they were going to get the money. Millions and millions of dollars from the state of Arkansas to this very specific corporation that then said, here's how you're going to teach. And that kind of bothers me because we didn't have any input in that.
Yeah, and that's my problem with it. It's, for me personally, it's driving what I think is going to end up in a lack of individuality in teachers and delivery and creating prepackaged lessons. And I think the real downside for me is that they're taking and building off of work that you've put decades in. I'm almost to a decade in. And they expect it to be theirs. And I think that is my biggest problem with it. Look, we can work around some of the other details, right? We can get on the same page. We can sort of find our own voice. But I worry about the future and where it's headed rather more than I worry about how it is presently.
Well, I also worry about new teachers coming in who don't see we're veteran teachers and we have our understandings of how our curriculum works and our particular, like we know our strengths and we know, and then we push each other to delve in. We're constantly learning on how to do this job better and how to tell a better story. or make these connections. And we had this actually conversation just the other day. Like, we're really good at seeing what each other is doing in each of our classes, because maybe it's A push or maybe it's my stuff with Euro or World or Art History, and then what he's doing with Gov and Comparative. And then we go, wow, that's cool, and that fits into my thing because of this. And so we kind of do what we do without their help. But there are people who may need that structure, who may need that sort of guidance to help them get on a better level. But I agree with Nixon. It's not my job to teach other teachers how to teach. And that's been a weird part of what's happened here as well. They kind of expect us to be the models and then also the almost like administrators that aren't paid for being administrators. I don't know. I don't want to bore people with the details necessarily, but that has been a real struggle because that's way above my pay grade. I'm not somebody else's boss. You know, we're collaborators. We're peers. We're colleagues. But don't put me in an advisory role when that's not really what I'm here to be.
Okay. Next question.
This is going to be a good one. I can tell.
I can tell.
My name is TJ Cardell. Let me pull up the quote.
Uh-oh.
All right. In the song "Wash Us in the Blood" by Kanye West featuring Travis Scott, Kanye said, "You know what's fake if it's in the news. Ooh, yeah." What's y'all's opinion on this statement? Is Kanye West correct?
Not really, but I would assume not everything in the news is fake, but there is fake news. So
yeah, I probably teach more units and lessons on media than anybody else up here, because I do it in seminar, I do it in Gov, I do it in Comparative. And look, yes, things exist in the media that are false, that are fake. You have to be intelligent enough to find the truth. And that's gotten harder and harder to do. And you have to find trusted sources. And that's gotten harder and harder to do. And
although not impossible.
No, it's not at all impossible. And that's one of the things that I focus on a lot more in USGov probably than any of them. But is, how do you spot bias? Can you spot it? What does it look like? Do you know it when you see it? And that's what we need to be teaching you guys, because... I don't want to take it back to the social media thing, but look, everything you see on TikTok or Snapchat or whatever you're looking at, is just because it's there, it doesn't mean it's true. And we have to have the ability to going forward process what's true and what's not, and figure it out based on context and based on what you see. Not to get all George Orwell, but you know, the last command, last and most important command was to reject what you see and what you hear, your eyes and your ears. And that's what people want you to do when they want you to be a follower. They want you to reject what you see, reject what you hear, and not think for yourself, right?
That's why it's so important for you to be in classes like ours, honestly, because our main goal, and not just ours, but I mean, we do, I think, a great job of that, is to push you to be critical thinkers. Think for yourself. Don't just take something at face value. Really think through what you're being presented with, and then question that. Why is it that way? Why did it? You know, especially when it comes to media. Like, don't just accept something at face value.
Oh, yeah.
You know, be a critical thinker. Why is that person saying what they're saying? Not everything is, yes, everything has its own particular bias, but that doesn't discount the reality that some person with a certain position may have. And also, just as I end this off, please understand that when people go, you know, there's two sides to every argument. Okay, that might be true. There might be even three or four sides to every argument. But that doesn't mean that every single side has the same validity. And that matters more than just about anything else. Does this person who's speaking with this attitude have a valid stance? Do they have credibility? Can I trust that at all? Or are they just making noise? So just because somebody has an argument and somebody has a counter argument doesn't mean that they have the same weight, or you should take them equally seriously. But you have to be smart enough to figure out which one is which. Kanye?
I think y'all actually would do a better job with this than the millennials did. They got tripped up by all this. But you guys have grown up in a world with a lot of stuff thrown at you. So hopefully you're starting to fine tune this meter.
I had a fake media moment and a fake media lesson.
Well, and it's the same thing as us. Like, you also should question what we tell you. Question. Be skeptical. We're not going to lie to you, but you should always be skeptical. You should also, you know, that's...
Socratic method, why?
Okay.
Question everything.
Yep.
All right. So my name's Dana Montgomery, and here's a little hypothetical. So you're on the intermediate playground, and there are bloodlusted kindergartners. They want you dead, no matter what. How many kindergartners do you think it would take to take you out?
Yeah, Pumphrey.
You're going to pick them up and swing them, yes?
The first one that comes to me.
This is okay, here's what weirds me out. You people who have not heard him answer this before, he's thought about this. He's actually thought through a strategy. Just in case.
Just in case. You've got to be prepared. Have all a plan, people.
All right, so go. What do you tell him?
You grab the first one closest to you, and you use them as a weapon. And then everybody else will think of twice, you know. I don't think they're going to have a plan. So that's the thing, is you got to, they're kindergartners. They're stupid. They don't know what they're doing. So you just grab one of them and start, and make a lot of noise. And they're going to get discombobulated. There's no leadership. Yeah, I think I could take them all out.
If there was leadership, let's just say that Tiny Hitler was there.
I was about to say, I found a job for Tiny Hitler.
And they had some coordination and maybe some weapons. Like, how many would... No, take the weapons out. If they just swarmed you physically, how many would it take?
I mean, yeah.
I mean, you're a pretty big dude, so how many would it take?
I would hurt a few of them. I'm taking some of them with me. I don't know how many it'll take, but I'm not going out without a fight.
Does anybody know how many kids we have in our kindergarten at Lakeside? I mean, what if they revolted? Like, what if they stormed the junior high first and take all those people out, you know?
But if that happens, you understand there's no etiquette in this. I'm talking eye poking, hair pulling. I'll do whatever. It's life or death, people.
Yeah, there are no rules.
Yeah, there's no rules. So I don't think they're prepared for the amount of rage that I could bring up. Look at me. Mm-hmm. This could go wrong. No, it won't. I'm just kidding, Ben.
We got to have a strategy. Apparently, this is not the first time that's come up.
No, I actually thought about it first. With those drills we were doing, if somebody broke into my classroom, what would I do? And I'll grab
throw
the smallest student. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Or the one.
Yeah, or the one. Okay, sorry, that's not going to happen. Just kidding.
That's weirdly fun to think about.
I'm not going to lie. I definitely cannot one-up that question. But my name is Robert Bledsoe, and who is a more evil ruler, Darth Vader or Adolf Hitler?
Isn't Vader based off Hitler?
Is he?
I believe so.
I mean, Hitler was real, so he was a little more evil than the fake Darth Vader who didn't actually kill people.
Of course, that's the answer.
So, yeah, but if, you know, Hitler himself, how many people did he actually kill? You know, that's the thing. It's like Darth Vader really used the Force.
Two that we know of.
I don't know.
His wife and himself.
Oh, his wife and himself. Yeah. And his dog.
Not the dog.
What did the dog do?
Some of those dogs were Nazis. They trained them.
Okay. All right. Is there any we got time for? Maybe one more and then anybody else?
Shout it out. I didn't even come to the... Oh, okay. No, we got somebody up.
Last question.
Here we go.
Hi. My name is Bryant Pennington, and what are some of your favorite history fun facts that you wouldn't know if you weren't a teacher?
I usually have 1,000 of these.
I know, right?
And now okay. I just learned, and I should have known this, but George Washington didn't wear a wig. Dun, 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 dun. I knew he had fake teeth. We know all the things, but I just learned like this year or last year that that was his real hair, and he spent about 35 to 40 minutes every morning getting it perfect and powdering it and all that, so he didn't wear a wig. Now, a lot of people did wear wigs, but by the time our founding fathers came along, it was really kind of going out of style pretty quickly, and so like Thomas Jefferson didn't wear a wig. John Adams did, but he was bald. So there's that.
You know, the other reason for the no wig thing, that's how they avoided that tax, because there was a wig tax and a powder tax.
And so, also syphilis.
And also syphilis, apparently.
Yeah, King Louis. That's true. People lost their hair. They had wigs. That's where it came from. Yeah. And a big wig, right? Richard, it got 40 wig makers. Cost a lot of money.
Because
you're a big wig, and we still use that expression. Oh, yeah, big wig.
How does the wig and the syphilis go together? I just don't...
One of the most common side effects of having syphilis is hair loss. We got syphilis from the Native Americans, apparently. We gave them smallpox, killed 90%. Syphilis. And people's hair, and King Louis XIV was super vain about his hair loss, and so he got 40 wig makers to make him this wig, and he set the style as King of Paris, and everybody followed suit, and wigs became popular, and it showed that you were upper class, and that caught on, and people wore wigs even if they didn't have syphilis, because that was the thing to do.
Well, that's kind of rude. You need to know who has syphilis.
Yeah.
The syphilis people are hiding beneath their wigs.
That's another thing I wouldn't know if I wasn't a history teacher. Along with a million other things, people.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
I'm going to go with your syphilis thing. I don't have a better answer than that.
The First Amendment is not the First Amendment. It was the third proposed amendment. The two didn't pass, and the original First Amendment is now the 27th.
Yes, James Madison proposed a bunch of them, right? 12 were approved, 10 were...
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, that's some history trivia, and I'm sure we have plenty more of that. But that's History After Hours. Thanks to Collective Coffee. Thank you guys so much.
Hey.
Goodbye.